we now go on to the other modality that we can certainly use in diagnosis and sometimes in treatment, which is the radiological approach. And Dr. Susan O'Hara from the Boston Medical Center, she's a clinical associate professor, will talk about radiological approaches to occult GI bleeding.
Good afternoon. I'd like to thank the moderators and Dr. Jennifer Sen of Boston Medical Center for inviting me to speak today. I'd like to present the perspective of an interventional radiologist dealing with lower GI bleeding predominantly. I don't have any conflicts of interest disclosed, but however, with anything in interventional radiology, there's a lot of off-label uses that will be discussed. So the scope of the problem, there's almost 400,000 admissions for GI bleeding every year with mortality rates upwards of 9% at a cost of almost $6.5 billion in inpatient care. These patients are very complex. They vary in their presentation, and the bleeding can be intermittent and occult, like we're talking about today. And when we're lucky, it's acute and massive when we can get them to angiography and definitive embolization quickly. That tends to be the unlikely situation. So this is an actual picture of one of my partners taking a consult on an occult GI bleed. But I know we're all chuckling about this, but it is a frustrating situation, not just for us, but I think in particular for families and patients. As Doug said, they have multiple repetitive procedures. There's an ongoing transfusion requirement. There are repeat or prolonged hospitalizations. There's an uncertainty associated with rebleeding. And I'm sure there's an uncertainty with maybe perhaps they feel like they're sitting on a ticking time bomb, and that would significantly impact their quality of life. The predominant focus of my talk is going to be lower GI bleeding. I think upper endoscopy is the better treatment and better modality for upper GI bleeding, and the main role of radiology is in lower GI bleeding. Lower GI bleeding is generally thought of as distal to the ligament of Treitz, and in these images here, we see a depiction of the superior mesenteric artery as well as the inferior mesenteric artery. The vast majority of cases of lower GI bleeding are due to either colonic diverticular or angiodysplasia, as Doug just talked about. You can often see neoplasms, post-surgical reasons, or other inflammatory causes of lower GI bleeding. One of the good and bad things about lower GI bleeding is it does spontaneously stop in 80% of patients. But this can in and of itself pose a very difficult diagnostic and management issue, particularly when multiple radiological studies and endoscopic studies are negative. And failure to localize in bleeding can occur in up to 65% of cases, predominantly because it's chronic and slow, or when they're actually doing the imaging, that active large volume hemorrhage that we all like to intervene upon has already stopped. So from my perspective, my goals really are to optimize the patient selection so that when we perform an angio, we can really visualize that active extravasation and treat with embolization. And we want to be able to get distally enough in the bowel so that we can not take out any of the major branches and cause any intestinal ischemia, because that's one of our dreaded complications. So I'm going to briefly just talk about the sensitivity and specificity of the radiographic evaluations, because I think that factors into when we do angiography and when we would consider provocative angiography. So nuclear medicine is, again, kind of a double-edged sword for interventional radiologists, as I'm sure it is for you guys. A TAG red cell scan can depict bleeding as low as 0.1 cc's per minute, so it's highly sensitive and specific. The nice thing about a TAG scan is it confirms that the bleeding is occurring fast enough to be seen. So if we can see it on a nuke med scan, sometimes we can see it on an angio. It also is very good in that it tends to localize to the upper tract or lower tract, and it can give us a general idea of the general vascular distribution. So if I see a TAG scan that's positive in the left upper quadrant, I will typically start with an SMA injection just to see if it's off the middle colic, but an IMA injection also wouldn't be unreasonable. The disadvantage to a TAG scan is it doesn't show any etiology, any other concerns that as an angiographer I'm going to have, and it can also be time consuming. It takes an hour to call on the tech, an hour to tag the scan, tag the red blood cells, and an hour to do the scan. So sometimes at 1 o'clock in the morning, that can also be an advantage. This is probably the best nuclear medicine scan I've ever seen of a GI bleed. Oops, sorry. Ah, sorry. here we go. And this depicts the TAG red cells in the aorta and the iliacs. And then after 5 minutes, we see the tagged, the radio tracer appearing in the left upper quadrant, becoming brighter over time. And then with the bowel peristalsis, the radio tracer diffuses along the left, along the descending colon and into the sigmoid colon. CTA is honestly what I prefer to get. It tends to be quick, it's accessible, and it gives us a lot of information. It tells us about the patient's anatomy, and it tells us whether they're bleeding quickly enough for us to see. It's very highly sensitive and specific to bleeding, and offers alternative explanations for bleeding. And it helps with, again, my planning. There's nothing worse than coming in at 2 o'clock in the morning to find out either the patient doesn't have femoral pulses, so I can't get to the bleeding, or that their IMA is occluded, and I can't get there. The disadvantages, again, it's the bleeding rate is about 0.3 cc's per minute. That's estimated in animal models. So it's not nearly as sensitive as a nuclear medicine scan, but it's more sensitive than an angio. And this is a typical CT that we would see. So this is a non-contrast study, so we don't want to give oral contrast. And then a contrast study performed in the arterial phase, showing a dense contrast bolus in the aorta and the SMA. And then going back, we see arterial extravasation here in the descending colon that on the delayed phase is peristalsing and diffusing a bit. So again, my goal is to make sure we select those patients accurately, knowing that angiography is not as sensitive. Depending on how you select the patients, angiography is somewhere between 40 and 85% sensitive for bleeding, but when we actually see it, it's highly specific. And again, we need to see that active extravasation in order to do an embolization very distally. Typically, a bleeding rate of 0.5 to 1 cc per minute is expected. Again, intermittent bleeding is the major limitation, and those very resuscitation efforts that we like to see can limit our angiographic results. The best predictor of a positive angio is someone who's unstable and requiring an ongoing transfusions, greater than 5 units of packed red cells. We used to tell our fellows that if they didn't smell like bloody stool when they walked in the rooms to consent the patients, it wasn't going to be a positive study. Predictors of negative angios, again, if they have a negative TAG scan or a negative CTA, they're not going to have a negative angio. Huxakul in 2014 reported his results with embolization of patients who had active extravasation. He had a 99% technical success, a 71% primary clinical success, and a 4% rate of bowel infarction, which is again why it's extremely important to make sure that as an interventional radiologist that we follow these patients afterwards to check their abdominal exams carefully for peritonitis, and where bowel ischemia is suspected after embolization, that we involve our surgical colleagues. These are typical devices used for embolization. So on the left here, you see stainless steel coils coated with a thrombogenic substance. And then on the left here, these are nitinol and platinum coils that are also coated with a thrombogenic substance as well. These coils here typically on the right are the ones we use in GI bleeds because they fit through very small microcatheters distally. So going back to our original patient showing the positive TAG scan and the positive CTA, we brought this patient down for a mesenteric angio. And this is an injection of the superior mesenteric artery here. And we see a very nice middle colic here going over to our splenic flexure. And there was no bleeding here seen. So we interrogated the IMA. So again, our access is from the right common femoral artery. We have a catheter up into the aorta, and then the catheter selecting the IMA. And here we see the ascending branch of the left colic, and then in that left upper quadrant, consistent with the bleeding seen on the nuclear medicine scan and the CTA, we see bleeding here in the left upper quadrant. Now in this case, we got out there with our microcatheters and we didn't see any bleeding. So what to do? Well, we can do CO2 angiography. So CO2 is an excellent contrast agent. It can be used when people have renal failure in lieu of regular contrast. It also has other properties which make it desirable, particularly in these circumstances. It's very highly soluble and less viscous than contrast. So where blood tends to mix with contrast, CO2 will displace contrast. And so when you're actually trying to see someone bleeding, it can be very helpful. So in this case, we did a CO2 angiogram, which we followed with a regular conventional contrast angiogram. And at that point, we were able to see the bleeding here. We got our catheters up a little further. We deployed our coils. We pulled our catheter back. And then we injected. And again, now no more bleeding. So what to do when you have a negative angio? So you've really exhausted your resources there. Typically, again, we go back to our endoscopic colleagues for those deep enteroscopies. And we all get together as a team and try to figure out what the best way is to proceed. But when the bleeding occurs again and it remains occult and recurrent and refractory, and the patient's not a surgical candidate, so kind of not an entirely unusual circumstance, but a pretty extenuating circumstance, we consider doing further interventions. So when I was doing some research for this talk, I came across an editorial entitled Provocative Endoscopy, Let Sleeping Dogs Lie or Grab the Tiger by the Tail. And so for the purposes of this talk, the remainder of the talk is going to be grabbing the tiger by the tail. So provocative angiography was first described in 1982. There are many small case series, and really was not widely used because of the fear of catastrophic bleeding. Fortunately, no bleeding complications have ever been reported. The interventional radiology group at Duke has the largest experience with provocative angiography, first describing their experience in 2001 and subsequently in 2010. And Dr. Kim in 2010 described his criteria for inclusion and exclusion for provocative angiography. And typically, these patients had refractory, recurrent, occult, lower GI bleeding, in whom collectively as a team, gastroenterology, surgery, and IR were all in agreement that proceeding with provocative angiography, the benefit greatly outweighed the risk. They excluded patients who had contraindications to TPA, such as major surgery, trauma, biopsy within 7 days, recent stroke or neurosurgery. Their protocol was to select the artery of primary concern, so the one that they thought they had the best shot at. They performed a diagnostic angio to see if at that last minute they were able to see any bleeding. They subsequently gave heparin IV on a weight-based protocol, then delivered intra-arterial nitroglycerin or other vasodilators, but typically nitroglycerin, and repeated the angio. In the off chance that it was positive. None of them were that were reported in this study. At that point, they started an infusion of TPA. The lowest dose that they saw bleeding at was 4 milligrams, so they suggest that you start with 4 milligrams. And the TPA was infused over 1 to 3 minutes, and then they followed up with an angio every 5 to 10 minutes. And they repeated that cycle until the procedure was either terminated or the angio was positive, and they proceeded with embolization. And again, just some background on TPA, its half-life is less than 5 minutes. And when you administer TPA for treating an MI, there's even at 100 milligrams, so quite a bit more than we would administer here, the rate of CVA is about 0.4%. But the thing to keep in mind here is that we're not delivering TPA at high doses like this, and the TPA that is being delivered is likely not making it into the systemic circulation, because it is largely metabolized by the liver. So delivering it into the SMA or the IMA, it's going to be metabolized by the liver and not make it into the systemic circulation at any significant concentration. And if it was, it's not going to be for a very long period of time. So these images were actually taken from Dr. Kim's article. And this is an SMA injection here. We do not see any bleeding. We provoke the bleeding. And now we don't see the bleeding, but we do see the nice little coil that they deployed here. So importantly from his study, they found of the 36 procedures that were performed, 1/3 of those procedures depicted active extravasation. And of those patients who had active extravasation, 92% of them had definitive procedures. For the patients who had did not have extravasation and did not have embolization, 44% of those had a recurrence. So this is just important to remember because 100% if you are able to see the extravasation, you're 99% of the time you're going to be able to treat it. And of those patients who you're able to treat, they're going to be better off in the long term and they're not going to have recurrent bleeding. So, and of the patients you don't provoke and you don't see the bleeding, almost half of them are going to have a recurrence. So Dr. Kim and his group decided to look to see if they could drill down on who would have a positive provocative mesenteric angiogram and who had was more likely to have a negative mesenteric provocative angiogram. And unfortunately, they really weren't able to come to any great conclusions there. In 2018, Sildiroglu reported his results, and very similar to Dr. Kim, one-third of his patients had a positive angio after provocation and two-thirds had negative angios. They had a 90% technical success and a 71% clinical success. I think the really important thing, though, is that they did these Kaplan-Meier curves, and you can look at their mortality of these patients. So of the patients who had, in this upper chart here, you can see this is, reflects the clinical success. Sorry. And these patients, in those first, if you depict these first 12 months, the patients who had clinical success had greater survival than the ones who did not have, who had a clinical failure, although these results were not statistically significant. And then when you look at the patients who had early rebleeding, they did demonstrate a statistically significant, sorry, improvement in, excuse me, a statistically significant decline in mortality. That's depicted here, especially I think in these first 12 months. So this is early rebleeding, and this is no early rebleeding. So the American College of Gastroenterology recommended that provocative angiography be considered in the setting of negative, so ongoing overt bleeding, and negative video capsule endoscopy, deep enteroscopy, and CT evaluation. My conclusions really are that it's a very challenging clinical situation, which really requires a team effort. When conservative measures and endoscopy are not able to control recurrent refractory bleeding and surgery is not an option, I think it's a great idea to try this. I think mesenteric angio is very safe and effective, and the concerns of uncontrolled bleeding have not been reported. Ischemic complications can occur, and it's very important to have our surgical colleagues on board for when that does occur and in the off chance that we did get into a situation where there was uncontrolled bleeding. I think if provocation fails, you really have to carefully follow these patients or consider your surgical options given the high mortality that is associated with the rebleeding rate and the high rate of recurrence of rebleeding. Thank you.